that Steve just dummies us down. And a couple times I said, Steve's going to kill me for this, but I don't care.
Well, whiskey, come and take my pain. No, my heart needs my brain. Oh, whiskey, don't you let me go. Whiskey, won't you help me hide?
From powerlineblog.com and produced by ricochet.com, this is the Three Whiskey Happy Hour with your bartenders, Steve Hayward, John Yu, and Powerline's International Woman of Mystery, Lucretia.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Three Whiskey Happy Hour. This is your co-host, John Yu, and I get to be the questioner today of my other two co-hosts, Steve Hayward and the lovely international woman of mystery, Lucretia. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey, John. It's so great John. To see you.
We get to be hecklers this week. Is that our roles? I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yes. What people can't tell, because they can't see the video, Steve is in his usual windowless dungeon room with all his high-tech equipment. But Lucretia is in a totally different room. People may not realize this, but usually when we tape, Lucretia and Steve are both in strange dungeons, like they're getting ready for the fall of civilization. But Lucretia's in this very cheery office with flowers on her desk and inspirational portraits on the wall. I see a poster that says Onward Victory with Churchill. I mean, this is very moving. Lucretia, what's going on? Why have you revamped your background and your surroundings?
Because Eric Swalwell targeted my house with a nuclear weapon and it's torn apart inside and out. And my office was occupied by painters and construction people. And so I was given the admonition, if you want to record anything and not hear banging, you better stay at work. So here I am.
I'm going to let that slide. I will, John, this has been taking me forever, but the reason I'm in actually almost literally a closet off my garage is that I'm renovating my house. It's taking 3 years.
Yeah.
But when it's done, oh boy, you're going to see the Pacific Ocean as my backdrop live from my fancy home office when it's all redone. It's still got another 3 months to go, probably, I hope. We'll see.
Well, we ought to have an inaugural party where we'll invite all the listeners nearby to show up. We'll do a live taping on your deck.
Yeah. Well, I've done that before. I've
all
actually
14 and a half of them?
Right. Look, I'm still jealous. You know, now you've had two podcasts without me, one to discuss envy, which of course I was envious of, and then you had another one with people bringing ammunition and stuff to the
we
ammo
missed you,
girl.
John,
you guys
we talked
had such
about
a good
you.
Time.
We talked
oh,
about
you had such
you.
A good time without me.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll do it live sometime, in front of a big audience. We'll have
and
to figure
really
that
quickly,
out.
John, one of the things we did was we took a longtime listener of the podcast who was the inspiration for Don't Forget to Milk the Soft Serve Power Dividend. Many months ago, I said, if I ever make it to South Carolina, we're going to get soft serve together. Because I said, I live in this one horse town that doesn't really have soft serve. And then he really got upset with me when he found out I got a Tesla. Because he said, you know, you're not a greenie, you're not
as were we all.
I know, you got to say that, you got to understand now that with the whole thing with Elon, I'm very proud of having a Tesla now. But anyway, I explained the whole situation, as I've explained to you guys, with my dad and everything. So he sort of forgave me. But Steve went with us. We went to Sonic and had a soft serve. And Doppler drove my Tesla. And what did he say at the end, Steve?
I think he thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. It's pretty cool. Steve said the same thing. Yeah. He said, okay, I like the car. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, just had to get that out there and just remind Jim that we had a great time. And
Yeah, we did. It was fun.
Yeah, another thing I'm envious of. You went around on some mad dessert spree in electric cars. I feel so excluded. I'm going to file a complaint with my DEI officer there was no inclusion going on.
There was
here.
No inclusion. And okay. Actually, the driver got up to about what? I want to say 90 in a 25 mile an hour zone for about 2 seconds.
Oh,
and then
but it only takes a half a second to get practically.
Yeah, in a Tesla.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start on with the serious topics of the show. The first one is, let's maybe we'll discuss some of the developments that are going on in Washington and with the 2024 elections and with politics. First up, Joe Biden gets a serious primary contender in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Our I thought you meant Marianne Williamson.
Well, I said serious. I said serious. Not sure actually if that applies to RFK Jr., but RFK Jr. immediately gets into the double digits before anybody knows anything about him. Is this just, let me start with Steve. Is this just nostalgia for the Kennedy visage and the New England accent and the name and Camelot? Or is it actually a serious vote of opposition to President Biden being reelected by his own party?
Well, all right. So I'm going to have a prediction that I think there's a 50-50 chance that Biden does draw a quote unquote serious challenger. That is to say, you know, a well-known serious political practitioner. And I think that person might be Andrew Cuomo. I'll come back to that in a minute.
What? But, Andrew Cuomo?
Yeah. I'll tell you why in a minute.
His new girlfriend.
Does he have, I didn't know that part. No, look, I mean, I don't know if it's Kennedy nostalgia or what. I thought by now the number of baby boomers are, you know, I guess there's still enough baby boomers around to get him to 15% of the vote in the Democratic primary. I've always thought he was a nut, except he's suddenly making sense. I mean, he put out a tweet earlier in the week saying the southern border's out of control. We can have sensible immigration, but the current situation's intolerable. I mean, he's clearly, any other things he's been saying suggest that he's got some of the political calculating skills of his father and uncle. Both of his uncles, actually. Well, actually, not so much Teddy, whose run for president was a disaster in 1980. But anyway, now here's the other, here are two wrinkles about this. One is the Democrats have decided, the Democratic National Committee has decided that, you know, New Hampshire's too white, so is Iowa. They can't go first. The first primary will be South Carolina. Well, now here's the problem. And of course, that was Biden's breakout state in 2020. Here's the problem. The New Hampshire has a statute saying their primary must go first, and Republicans control the legislature. They're not going to change it. So likelihood is you're going to have a Democratic primary going off in January, and Joe Biden will not compete in that primary. And the Democratic National Committee may tell New Hampshire, you won't get any delegates if you hold your primary first. And New Hampshire's going to say, tough, we're going to do it anyway. Now, I think that if there's a Republican Secretary of State, they're going to put Joe Biden on the ballot because they're going to say all declared candidates must be on our ballot, even if they haven't formally filed. I'm not sure if that's the law, but the point is Robert F. Kennedy could win or get 50% of the New Hampshire primary. And that starts to look like 1968 when, you know, Eugene McCarthy almost knocked off LBJ, but brought, ironically enough, Robert F. Kennedy Sr. into the race, and that finished LBJ. Okay. Then I caught Andrew Cuomo somewhere on TV a week or two ago saying, I think there should be a serious challenger to Biden. I don't think he should just skate through with no serious opposition. And there's some other things that he's been doing in the last couple of weeks that make me think maybe he's thinking about it. He's been clearly plotting a comeback. And if you think about it, he owes nothing to the Democratic Party, because when all the Me Too accusations came at him, they cut him off, and he owes them no loyalty whatsoever. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if we wake up here 2-3 months from now and find out that Andrew Cuomo is thinking of getting in the race, and that'll be an interesting moment.
Matter. Nobody's going to vote for him. Does he owe anything to the thousands of elderly people he killed by putting them in nursing homes?
Yeah, but he doesn't know that. So, yeah, no, he... Yeah. Well,
Lucretia, okay. How about what's Lucretia's thoughts, especially we've got RFK Jr., who's, I thought his main claim of fame before are suspicion of vaccines and big science.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what? Everybody made fun of him back then. I'm not so sure that I follow. And he doesn't want to talk about the vaccines. He says that's not what people care about. That's not what I care about. That's not why I'm running for president. I don't know what to make about vaccines. I do believe that, you know, for the longest time, medical science was absolutely trustworthy when on the whole vaccine front for many, many decades. And it was a positive influence on the world. Let's leave that aside. What I do think is true about RFK Jr. is that he says a lot of things that make a lot of sense to people. He's very skeptical of the COVID vaccine, which the more we learn about that, the more we learn there's a reason to be. Walensky, by the way, resigned. I'm so happy to hear that. he's skeptical of the way the war in Ukraine is being conducted. He's skeptical of the kind of moronic foreign policy being executed by this Biden administration. He does, I think, trade a little bit too often on his uncle and what his uncle would do in these situations. But when he talks, for instance, about Putin, he says, I think Putin's a bully. I think he's this. I think he's that. But if you're talking about actually conducting foreign policy, you need to think about things from Putin's perspective in order to understand what's really going on. And so, you know, he's saying a lot, and of course his commentary about corporatism and about the marriage of big tech and government and corporations was for many years a lefty talking point. But now, of course, what we understand is he's exactly right about that. And it's a place, I think, where populists a little bit on the left and a little bit on the right might be able to come together. What I really want to say overall, though, I don't agree with everything he says, but you know, that's not all that unusual. That whether he has a chance or not, too early for me to say. I'm not an expert on those things. But you look at him, and you look at Vivek, whom I've been paying a little bit of attention to lately. And with any luck, whatever else happens about who gets the nomination, they will actually change the confines, the limits of the debate. And maybe instead of Biden being able to stay in his basement and not answer any questions, that the media will be forced to have to take on some of these questions and to force the candidates, or at least to make them front and center. The government's response to COVID, the government's response to the Ukraine, the lies and things that are being told us about Ukraine, the government's the loss of the middle class over the last three decades. You know, there's all of these issues that we're actually seeing these somewhat fringe but wealthy and otherwise candidates who can automatically get a bit of a name for themselves, and they don't do it the traditional way. Maybe the debate changes a little bit. That'd be the best thing on earth for the country, regardless of who ultimately gets the nomination on either side, I think. There's my optimistic view for the day.
Well, can I, sorry about all the traffic noise. I've got the Rice-A-Roni streetcar going right by my window. But before we transition to the next topic, maybe observe that maybe RFK Jr. is a lot more like JFK and RFK, who were not as liberal, I think, when they were in office as the Camelot mythology makes them out to be afterwards. Yeah. That, you know, there was a reason JFK was in Texas when he was assassinated. It was because he was campaigning, to show he was conservative in Texas. And, RFK and JFK were not as interventionist abroad as people may, people seem to remember. And lastly, I'll throw this out just to tease Lucretia. Some people might think that JFK and RFK were the first targets of the deep state, right? Oh. They fought all the time with the intelligence agencies, right? They distrusted them over the Bay of Pigs. They distrusted the military and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And of course, you got all these conspiracy theories that somehow, which I don't believe, but which the CIA and the FBI were somehow involved with the assassination. But they were very much at odds with the government establishment and the national security state, from my memory of studying the Kennedys.
So, say is I had three people I know, they tend toward the conspiracy minded, but still, who said that was the reason that Tucker actually was fired. Because he pushed back so hard on the fact that the last release was no release at all, and that the CIA was still covering things up. And I don't happen to agree, but it's an interesting concept.
On the broader point, John, Steve, on RFK Jr. or RFK Senior, really. I mean, I think we do know that John F. Kennedy was a conservative cold warrior, right? A tax cutter, mm-hmm. right? He was, rising tide lifts all that business. Yeah. Now, Bobby Kennedy, he became a hero for the left after he was shot. And there's a really great book about him from 20 years ago by Michael Knox Baran. I think it was his first book called The Last Patrician. And it captures that Bobby Kennedy was actually pretty conservative in some of his social views. He was very critical of the new left, mostly privately. He was friendly to some of the early critiques of Daniel Patrick Moynihan on the Black Family. he wanted to be tough on crime. He'd been attorney general, right? And
yeah,
this is very obscure lore, but Nixon, who of course ran, as we all supposedly remember, on Law and Order in 68, was outraged in 67 and early 68 that Bobby Kennedy was getting to his right on Law and Order. This was all airbrushed out by the liberals who wanted to make Bobby Kennedy into Camelot II, the great liberal hero, the great healer. And you know, all that, a lot of that is just sort of bunk and post hoc liberal appropriation. So I don't know about the kid. I always thought he was a nut too, but we'll see.
we will see on the campaign trail. I can't wait for that first debate with the Biden and Kennedy versus Andrew Cuomo. What a great setup. God. So let's turn to another recent development. There's been a lot of activity on the Hunter Biden, Joe Biden corruption front. This week, it was revealed that members of Congress are demanding information from within the Justice Department and or the IRS, which apparently have whistleblowers who've come forward saying, one whistleblower is saying there's evidence of large-scale tax fraud and tax evasion by the Biden family, and by Hunter Biden in particular. And then there's another whistleblower who says there's evidence or allegations and perhaps evidence that Joe Biden took money from foreign governments during and after his vice presidency.
No. Say it isn't.
What do we make of all this? What do we make of all this, Lucretia?
I'm more interested in the fact that Hunter Biden was actually already paying his baby mama $20,000 a month.
Yeah.
That's a pretty lot amount of money. I mean,
I'm glad you mentioned that. Let me just throw that third one in there just to explain for the listeners. The other development was Hunter Biden went into family court in Arkansas to ask that his $20,000 a month, which I think goes pretty far in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Should be reduced.
It goes pretty far everywhere, but okay.
But should be reduced because, and so the guy's so stupid because he didn't realize that the judge would say, well, show me your financial documents so that you can prove you can't afford it anymore. So sorry, that was the third new.
No, that's really the point. I do want to. I'm going to go in another tangent. You're going to kill me, but I commented to somebody yesterday that while Kim Gardner was found in contempt of court for not showing up and sending, you know, to the trial court that she was.
Tell everybody who she is, though, Lucretia.
Oh, sorry, Kim Gardner, Soros planted attorney in Kansas. No,
St. Louis,
Missouri. Just a foul human being. She's, you know, 16,000 felony cases she refused to prosecute. She's just, and so she's also, it turns out, been going to nursing school, which is why she's not, you didn't know that? Yeah, she's going to nursing school in the daytime. And that
being district attorney's not good enough. You gotta get a nursing degree too.
It's bizarre. The whole story bizarre. But the funny thing is that she actually was held in contempt of court because she sent some low-level, it wasn't even a prosecutor, it was some low-level assistant to prosecute a case instead, and the court found her in contempt, which I found is really interesting. She didn't bother to show up even then, whereas Hunter flew all the way to Arkansas to show up for his case after the judge said, you have to be here. So there's a funny little comparison. But anyway, back to Hunter Biden. You do, it could be, it probably won't be. I know a lot of people are salivating at the thought of it. It could be the opportunity to have a different and more detailed look into Hunter Biden's finances, which would let us know what's really happening there, how much, for instance, he's making on those lovely paintings of his. And I think that's one of the big issues, right? That's one of his main sources of income when he's not working for Burisma or other international clients, shall we say. right?
I think there have been decently founded stories that when Biden was vice president and Hunter was tagging around on Air Force Two to China and other places, that there were white people in the White House counsel's office raising red flags about this.
Oh, yes.
Biden waved them off and said, shut up, he explained, and so forth. And one of the new allegations connects to the fact that maybe some of the people around the time saying this looks very shady to us and somehow it got buried. No surprise that somehow. I don't know what I have to say about the child support payments. I don't know much about that world, having never been divorced and had to pay child support, but $20,000 does seem a lot. There wouldn't be any alimony because they were never married. So it's all child support. I'm wondering if that's lost income because she was a stripper, and maybe that tells you what the market for strippers is in Arkansas. I don't know. I'd like to kind of run with that one and find out what the basis of it is.
It doesn't exactly work that way. She's responsible for her side of things for them in California. No, Arkansas. This is Arkansas.
Yeah, I don't know.
Based on what he can afford to pay. That's what they base it on.
Okay.
Because that child has as much... Since illegitimacy was became a protected category, according to the Supreme Court under the Constitution, an illegitimate child has as much stake in the income of the parent, of the non-custodial parent, as any child.
Well, now here's a mystery for you, Lucretia, is with all this money going to Ukraine, how come Hunter is not scoring more of those board seats on Ukrainian companies like he used to? That would solve all his financial problems.
Yeah, my guess is the more money he makes, by the way, the more money he'll be required to to pay. So
report.
He doesn't necessarily want to do that.
Or do we think we're going to show up in Kyiv, as we now call it, sometime soon and discover all kinds of government ministries with Hunter Biden paintings up on the wall?
I would imagine. I think they're more likely to be in China, if you want to know the truth.
But, okay.
right. You know, they're not bombing China right now.
Well, here, and here's the third development. So a little more tangential to the race in 2024, but important in terms of politics is we've seen the House Republicans passed a measure to lift the debt ceiling, but with some, I would say, modest spending cuts attached therein. Basically, if I remember correctly, returning us to 2020 spending levels and only allowing 1% per year growth in the federal budget in domestic accounts. But defying all predictions that Speaker McCarthy could get any kind of agreement among Republicans in the House.
Let me ask where do those predictions come from before you go on? Why did everybody believe there were just too many conservatives who wouldn't agree to a debt ceiling raise, or what?
Yeah, well, one was just, you remember the many votes to appoint McCarthy as speaker. But then second, there were a number of House Republicans who have never voted. This was their first time to ever vote for a lift in the debt ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people thought there would just be not just a protest vote, but just people would continue their principled opposition to increasing the debt ceiling. At the same time, President Biden has said all of those are non-negotiable and is demanding what's called a clean debt ceiling increase, which means no substantive provisions attached at all. And Janet Yellen, another Lucretia favorite, is said that the government will run out of money on June 1st, and then raised a constitutional issue, which is, I think, very interesting. In the 14th Amendment, it says that the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned, which people in the administration have floated the idea that that would allow President Biden to basically lift the debt ceiling unilaterally.
Yeah,
and start spending money out of the Treasury.
That the fifth article of the fifth paragraph of the 14th Amendment, well, none of the 14th Amendment gives any power to the president to do that, right? Congress shall have the authority under this provision authority under this country to enforce the provisions of this article. If you include the public debt, that means Congress can do it. And Congress started, they just got to get the Senate to go along with it. Right? I mean, the House did. So I think that's a stupid argument, but that's what you'd expect from the Biden administration. By the way, I've forgotten to remind everybody that I'm a stupidist.
The stupidest.
It's like a racist that people people supposedly hate people because of their race. Well, I hate people because they're stupid. prejudice against them because they're stupid.
I think that's bringing us back to our contest, which Steve and I failed miserably to use all the banned words at Stanford. And
oh, right. Yes.
Lucretia won that without even trying. And I think she just showed again.
I did have the list, but it came easy to me.
Natural flair.
Yeah.
I'm sure stupid is on the list, if I remember.
Yeah.
It is. And I don't remember what you were supposed to use instead.
So I think the most interesting, well, not the most interesting, but a very interesting angle of what McCarthy got through is one that's not drawing a lot of attention. So talking about spending cuts, and of course, you know, Democrats don't want spending cuts. They don't want rescissions to the COVID money. They don't want to roll back Green New Deal. But one of the conditions that was added, and this might have gotten a few of those reluctant conservative House member votes, was tying a work requirement to food stamps and other welfare benefits. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't actually have a direct fiscal impact, I don't think. But I suspect that's where the left really wants to draw a line, because they hate the idea of work requirements. By the way, that doesn't just poll very well. I mean, if you ask Americans, you know, you think there should be work requirements in exchange for food stamps and federal benefits, it usually gets about 80% support. And there's lots of other indications that, you know, you talk to people outside the Beltway, outside the ruling class, the majority of Americans really hate the welfare system. And so I think that's an interesting one where, you know, McCarthy might actually give a little bit on some of the spending things. I don't know. I wish he wouldn't. But that's the one I think that's really going to divide the left.
The other one, though, Steve, that came up this last week was the elements of the Green New Deal that, of course, here's shock of shocks, that it turns out it's going to be a lot more expensive than what they told us at the time that it was passed to get all of these greeny projects through. And so they have, in fact, pushed back on a bunch of the infrastructure, the different things passed last year. That, you know, we're just funneling billions into companies, into, you know, boondoggle after boondoggle. And so that is, some of those provisions are being, to the extent possible, also scaled back. And
well, there are two comic elements to this. I say comic, I mean, totally deserved ironies that were utterly predictable. One is there was a special exemption for tariffs on Chinese solar panels, because guess what? 80% of our solar equipment, something like that, comes from China. And the Senate, Democrats in the Senate, several of them just went along with the House in voting to reestablish that tariff. And all the solar power people are saying, we can't afford to do this if we can't get cheap Chinese panels. Second thing is, you can build panels from coast to coast, but if you can't site the transmission lines to send the power around, then it's not going to do very much. And guess what? The permitting reform that was supposed to be part of the deal for Joe Manchin's vote hasn't happened. They stabbed him in the back. He's mad about it. He's now saying he will vote to repeal the Green New Deal. I think you remember me warning that that guy couldn't be trusted, and that I thought he was a lightweight. Yes. And I think he's the stupidest member of the Senate, if I'm going to be a stupidest. And
he's even close, but he is. Well, okay.
He's a fool, at least. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah. All right. But okay. No, I think Lucretia, you ought to have something nice to say about McCarthy, because that was impressive.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Crew, right? You're not usually on the McCarthy
team, McCarthy,
the McCarthy fan club, but well, hasn't he done well so far?
Goes back to what you said earlier, that he had a really hard time getting enough votes just to be Speaker. And remember, he got those votes because he made a number of concessions. Remember? Yeah. He made a number of concessions. And maybe all of that, I think he was always better than McConnell, for sure.
Maybe, mark this day down, John.
No, I've always said that. But maybe the culture inside of the House of Representatives has changed enough to allow his better instincts to rule, if that makes sense. I mean, what we always talk about all the time is the fact that you go to Washington, D.C. Steve said it just the other day. He quoted his mentor. I don't remember the quote, but that, you know, you go to Washington thinking you're going to drain the swamp and you find out it's a hot tub. And, you know, and we talk about that all the time. Maybe just in this one case, McCarthy is beginning to see, at least within his own party, a certain change of direction, change of attitude, whatever, change of environment, whatever you might want to call it, and saw the opportunity to say, I can maybe get some of these hardcore conservatives who don't want to vote to extend the debt limit to go along with this and have them see the pragmatic approach here, you know, and more power to him. I am always willing to praise people when they do right.
Wow. Wow. We have to mark this moment. As
wait a minute. I said something nice positive about Robert F. Kennedy, a Democrat.
But this is, no, I'm just saying, I hope Speaker McCarthy listens to this podcast. This is the first and only time I believe Lucretia has ever praised our poor Speaker of the House. So let's turn to a different subject. This is, I think now we're in maybe our third week of escalating attacks on the Supreme Court in general and on Clarence Thomas, my old boss in particular. This week saw actual hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee called by the Democrats, who still retain the majority, who are demanding a code of ethics on the part of the Supreme Court, threatening to pass one themselves. And this week, we've also seen several more stories. The one out today was that the allegedly nefarious Leonard Leo had money sent to Ginny Thomas's consulting company, but did not want it publicly reported. That was one development. Now, I think that was out just today. Out yesterday was a story in ProPublica, I believe, which said that Harlan Crow paid for the private school tuition of a boy related to Justice Thomas, who he had taken on as a kind of a ward, whose father, I believe, was in jail and in Georgia, and was the son. Son of Justice Thomas's sister. And then I believe an earlier story that I don't think we had a chance to talk about raised the claim that Justice Thomas had improperly forgotten to report a land sale, whereas Harlan Crow bought his mother's house and was intending to turn it into a museum. So Steve, let me start with you. Is there anything nefarious going on? B, what is really going on? And C, what effect is this going to have on a court that, you know, we were expecting would shortly be striking down affirmative action, race-based affirmative action, maybe cutting back on the administrative state, and is just off long-held goals of the conservative movement to overturn Roe versus Wade last year and to expand the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment.
This is a well-planned, well-coordinated temper tantrum from the left to attack an institution that they've lost control over, right? When the court was being activist from the New Deal, really up until just recent years, they were perfectly happy with it. I mean, they got same-sex marriage, right? They got abortion, they got all kinds of things. And now suddenly it's out of their control. So what? They have to delegitimize it. I think we remember now.
It's working, by the way, according to Alito.
It could be, but here's the point I'm coming to is they're going to regret this. They're going to regret this.
Really?
Yeah, here's why. I mean, well, first of all, think about how the Democrats already regret launching pressing the plunger to get rid of the filibuster for federal judge confirmation, right? That was Harry Reid doing that so they could pack the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals when they were losing under Obama. And, you know, remember Mitch McConnell said, you're going to regret this. You may regret it sooner than you think. All of the Trump justices could not have been confirmed over a filibuster, right? I'm not sure what would have happened, but you couldn't have got them on the court. And a lot of people said, boy, did Harry Reid ever screw that up? So now you're attacking the court and trying to bring down its legitimacy.
People can't see, but Lucretia just did a victory jig.
Right. Well, but here's why I say they're going to regret it. Not just, I'll put it this way. I keep going back to, and it's actually something I'm writing this week, about how the trust in government continues to fall. I look at those Gallup numbers in the late 50s when 80% of Americans said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing. Now it's about 15%. So what a great idea it is to attack the one branch of the federal government that's still held in high esteem by the public. Oh, by the way, the military is the other branch. And what are we doing in the military? Well, Lucretia has been telling us all about that, and she's right. So if you really want to trash the judiciary, because you're not going to be able, that's ultimately what's going to go on here is, you know, court packing is going to be proposed and lots of other things. I think that that is going to get one more reason for the broader American public to dislike the federal government, to dislike our ruling class, to distrust our institutions, and to be more cynical about government. Second point, and then I'll let Lucretia add in. If you look at some of the particular charges, I think James Taranto at the Wall Street Journal is on fire writing about this, about how bogus a lot of them are. And so, you know, it's strictly speaking, and I think this has been written about, is that what, you know, Harlan Crowe paying for a grandnephew of Justice Thomas to go to a private school, the kid was having problems, public schools weren't working very well. It doesn't even fall under any of the guidelines. Second point is, and I'm sure you know about this, John, is one reason the Supreme Court has somewhat different guidelines on recusal and so forth is that unlike the appeals court, if you have a judge who's conflicted out, you just swap in another appeals court judge, either from the bench of that circuit, or sometimes, as you know, you borrow judges from another circuit if you need a three-judge panel. That happens a lot. We can't do that in the Supreme Court. You don't have judges you can just drop in to take someone's place if they recuse themselves. So they have to have a little more latitude. Mm-hmm. The final thing I'll say is one of the stories you didn't mention is ProPublica found another cruise on Harlan Crowe's boat that he was on. And it mentioned Chris DeMuth was on that cruise. I actually heard about that cruise at the time it happened. Chris told me about it. Oh, yeah, we sailed up here on the Baltics. And, you know, Justice Thomas was there and three or four other people. We had a great time. And so I'm sort of laughing about this like this was some nefarious plot with Blofeld and Bond villains and Lord knows what all, right? It was, oh, anyway.
Well, here's the problem.
Lucretia, what are your thoughts about
this? Just give an opportunity to you know, do a little name dropping and then get to the real point, which is this, of course, is just an attack on Thomas is an especially important target for the left. Given everything Steve said about the court and so on, I agree with. But Thomas is the worst, of course. He's the worst of the worst because not only is he sharp, are his opinions grounded in principle and natural law and not in just some, you know, whatever. I mean, he's no Gorsuch. He's never going to decide a Bostock case. Okay, all right. So Thomas is the greatest threat from an intellectual point of view. Number one. Mm. Number two, he's the greatest threat because he's, you know, he's that particular term, that awful term from Uncle Tom's Cabin. He's not only a Black conservative man who's very, very smart, but he has a terrific story, of course, a terrific story of, you know, coming from a segregated South, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of these attacks are just nonsense. They're BS. You know, Harlan Crowe doesn't expect to get anything from Clarence Thomas. They have ideal. I mean, I like hanging out with my friends like you guys because we have things in common, the important things we believe in common. It's nice to be with people like that, right? You enjoy that more than you do with somebody who's got stupid, crazy ideas, unless they're just, you know, anyway, you get my point. What they are talking about, of course, is the fact that Sotomayor got what? What was it? $3 million?
$3 million, yeah.
$3 million in advances. I didn't even know she wrote a book, so it couldn't possibly be all
of
that.
Most of them are children, but people should realize most of these are children's books, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's why, because I don't have any little children anymore. But I didn't know she'd written any books. Supposedly it's several. And she got, and I as I understand that the Random House never actually recouped the advances that they gave her. So basically it was a campaign donation because who wants to read a book by Sonia Sotomayor, the wise Latina woman? Ooh, anyway, but she didn't recuse herself in I believe it was two different cases involving Penguin House, which is the parent company of Random or vice versa. I can never remember. Yes. She didn't recuse herself. Why are we not talking about, that's when it's a problem. That, and you know, I didn't follow the case. I don't give a damn about who does what there. But you know, for all I know, one was a case where the whole court decided not to grant certiorari, as I recall, and the other one they found against the person that was suing Random House.
I think in both cases they were cert petitions that were denied. They didn't take the case.
Yeah.
And here's the
I thought one of them they did, but okay.
Yeah, I think they didn't. And so the embarrassing part for her is that Justice Breyer, who has published a couple of readable books for much less money, did recuse himself from the cert petition review. But remember, again, John, you correct me if I don't get this quite right. You have to have four justices to grant accept a petition and hear a case. Now, if you recuse yourself, that's in effect kind of a no vote in a certain way, yes. Right? Sure. And so this, again, gets to the dilemma of do we naturally assume that Sotomayor couldn't be objective in this case? Maybe strictly speaking, you say, you know, a federal court judge would be, I think, would have to recuse. But then, like I say, you swap out another judge from another district bench to hear the case. Harder to do in the Supreme Court. So actually to say to recuse her from the case would have been actually against the interests of the publisher. Because it, I think I explained that very well, John.
No, but, I think it'd be in favor.
You did.
Yeah, okay.
Let me add another point, which I'm curious what you guys think. And then it naturally segues into our next topic, which is it also points out the ridiculousness of what passes for ethics in Washington, D.C.
Yes, yes. Right?
So notice the whole, there's no evaluation of the morality of what any justice is doing. It's whether you're filling out these ethics forms correctly. Right. So in the world of Washington, ethics is actually ethic, not even real ethics, right? This is not Nicomachean ethics. This is ethics forms, which are so impenetrable. That right, they're worse than IRS forms. I've had to fill them out in all three branches now. It's easy to make mistakes because the forms themselves don't make sense. But that's what. So the Congress wants the judiciary and the executive branch to fill out these ethics forms because ethics have replaced morality. Right? They're not asking, why not we just put out what they're doing and we can all evaluate the morality of what they're doing. At the same time, you have people in Congress who are very good at filling out their campaign finance forms, when in reality, you're effectively being bribed by interest groups who appear before you, ask you for legislation, and then give you massive campaign donations. Yeah. And that's seen as okay, right? So then you have a Congress which does comply with the ethics forms, but is committing what seems to me, you know, a massive immorality in the way they run their offices. So I was just struck by this, how ethics has come to substitute for actual morality.
Do you think there's a separation of powers issue here, or does this actually under Congress's power to make exceptions to, or
I thought that's where Steve was. Powers? I thought that's where Steve was going, was that it seems to me the lower courts are totally at the discretion of Congress. You know, the Constitution doesn't provide for lower courts. It says it's up to Congress. I could see a case for Congress passing ethics rules about lower court judges. But it seems to me with the Supreme Court, that's the Supreme Court's created by the Constitution. It's an independent branch. I got to think there's already, Congress has the right not to confirm someone. They have the right to impeach, you know, remove. I don't see where Congress has a right to continually regulate what you do as a judge other than getting on the bench and then being kicked off the bench. And so I think an ethics rule for the Supreme Court, I think would be, is arguably unconstitutional. Plus you have, and I think the court has talked about this, if it's plainly to interfere with the way the judges are actually deciding cases, then it's, you know, doubly unconstitutional.
Well, so if AOC is right, they don't have to listen to what the court says anyway, but okay. Are you guys ready for me to shock you one more time? To Robert's credit, he's basically said, Congress, screw you.
Yeah,
which I thought was the right answer.
I thought he did absolutely the right thing. But you know, remembering when he did the next after Schumer showed up on the steps here, what, a year or two ago, and said, you know, Gorsuch and Alito, you'll reap the whirlwind if you rule the wrong way on abortion. It's essentially what he said. And Roberts sent that very sharp note the next day, saying you're being irresponsible and reckless, and you should tone it down. I kind of wish Roberts had gone to the committee, walked in, made an opening statement saying, there's a political attack on the court. I won't stand for it. You people are a bunch of ninnies. And then got up and walked out. I thought that would have been
been good.
That would have been great.
Definitely not Roberts.
No,
nature.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, let's. The reason I promised that this would naturally segue into our next topic is
at least when I'm the host, I want to have this philosophy corner I've been promising. And so there's this great article. Great's the wrong word. Eyebrow raising article in the New York Times saying, why do conservatives care about Aristotle? So I thought,
you know, actually the headline, it's a little better than that, John. The headline is why conservatives can't stop talking about Aristotle. Yeah,
that's true.
I just fall in your chair laughing at this point, right?
let me ask our two philosophy friends here, especially to speak to our younger, you know, college, high school, even graduate school listeners. Why should they care about Aristotle? What do you tell students or parents who ask you, we're in the world of AI, data sciences, the internet. What is the point of reading Aristotle anymore? Maybe at best you can get students to read maybe a modern political theorist who talks about Aristotle, but what's the point, A, of talking about Aristotle himself? And then B, what do you tell people about why they should go into political theory and philosophy these days? Lucretia,
let me first answer that I don't tell anybody to go into political theory or philosophy these days.
Oh, you don't?
No, absolutely not. What I hope to do in a few cases is present enough about Aristotle in lectures and classes and so on to intrigue the very few students nowadays even capable of understanding Aristotle on their own. And then,
by the way, for people who can't see, Steve has just opened a whole bottle of scotch, so I think he's going to get ready to take on Lucretia on this.
No, but do you see my point? I'm not sure. The argument about whether or not Aristotle should be taught is not one you make to students. It's one we probably need to make to the people who'd like to get rid of the entire Western tradition altogether. But that's a different story. One can learn nearly everything they need to know about everything important in life, I think, by reading Aristotle. Mm. It's not enough, but if you had to choose one, remember, as Steve asked me last week, who would it be if you chose one book? I said the Bible,
right,
but our teacher said the Bible, the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle and Shakespeare. And, you know, to put those three into the same category, understand that there is a wealth of knowledge that one can glean about human beings, about human nature, about politics, about the important things from those three books that you certainly can't get from some modern political philosopher teaching about Aristotle.
Ask you, Lucretia, what is that? What is it that you get from reading Aristotle, you know, the original words, rather than reading, discussion of him by current philosophers? Like, isn't Michael Sandel and John Rawls enough in their discussion of what Aristotle said?
I'm just poking a bear. As a matter of practice, John, I rarely, if ever, assign secondary sources to primary thinkers. I don't believe in it. If a student, I don't even like to give too much of my own interpretation of things while students are introduced to Aristotle or even the Federalist Papers. You know, students have a really hard time reading the Federalist Papers because of the language and so on, but I don't give them synopsis. I don't give them the version of Cliff Notes. We work through it together. And I try not to put my own biases in as I'm introducing these things. And so I would never teach Aristotle through the lens of some, never mind Rawls. I don't think any student should be exposed to Rawls till they've been out of graduate school for 30 years. And then maybe, you know, they should probably know that something that horrible exists. But in the meantime, introduce students to Aristotle to learn what's good and beautiful about human beings, about human nature, about politics, what's not so good and beautiful about it, what's possible. Learn that human beings have an ultimate happiness and think about it in those terms. Aristotle can do that for students in a way that nothing else I can think of can.
So
Steve, they're missing out on utilitarianism.
I can do that.
They're missing out on social justice.
No, I can come to that. Aristotle. Okay.
What are your thoughts?
I will take that on. I'll try to in due course if I don't stray as I too often do. Look, I can remember as recently as the 1970s. Well, first of all, everyone knows the books that have been popular the last few years, you know, Cabinet Making for Dummies, you know, Catholicism for Dummies. We actually had Aristotle for Dummies published back in the 70s before that series started. It was Mortimer Adler's Aristotle for Everyone. And I remember reading it thinking, oh, this book is really stupid and simplistic. But that connected to, it was kind of the last gasp of that post-war Robert Maynard Hutchins great book series when people thought everyone should have some exposure to the great books. And that was before multiculturalism came along and said we should admire everybody's culture and hate our own, right? So I think two things ought to be said. One, let's give the subhead the New York Times story. So the head is why conservatives can't stop talking about Aristotle, like this is strange or something. The subhead is the 2,500-year-old roots of Ron DeSantis's education plan. Right away, there's a hint by saying, oh my God, this is some really old stuff. It's those dead white guys from ancient Greece who were terrible people. One of the things DeSantis wants to do is allow, in addition to the SAT and the ACT, I guess, are the two main tests, achievement tests you take for admission to colleges in Florida, is he wants to add, I think it's the CLT, the Classical Learning Test. This would be a test for kids who've gone to classical academies, kids who've been homeschooled, kids who've gone to maybe Catholic school, to show that they actually know something in the humanities from this great books tradition that is taught more seriously everywhere but public school, right? And of course, the secular left is the New York Times is one, ignorant of this, B, appalled by it because we're supposed to hate all this kind of a tradition, right? And so that's what makes it doubly amusing, but also kind of serious. So your direct question, point two, the reason we go back to Aristotle is he is the first political scientist and still the best political scientist because he understands the unity of human thought, that you can't have statecraft without a capacious view that takes in human character, the natures of regimes, the nature of laws. I mean, you know, it's hard to even summarize how wide his view was, which contrasts to, by the way, you know, our own political science department down the hill from us, John, at Berkeley. I mean, they're very good, a lot of good people there, but for a lot of them, their view, I've heard him say this, is you can't study what you can't measure. Aristotle didn't measure anything in that sense of statistics the way we do it today. But if you can't study what you can't measure, then you can't talk about virtue in any intelligible way these days for that kind of political science. Or justice, correct. They sneak in all kinds of presumptions about justice. By the way, you said utilitarianism, Rawls, whatever, social justice. Well, Aristotle, and I've sometimes laid out for students the four different kinds of justice that Aristotle laid out, which was what? Help me out, Lucretia.
Distributive
justice, commutative justice. What were the other two? I don't have my notes. But what I find is the students, their eyes get really big and they write these down. They'd never heard of them before. These would be advanced students at UC Berkeley and other places who've never heard of Aristotle's categories of justice, which differed significantly from what we call social justice today and all the rest of all that. So,
which is an oxymoron.
Of course, right. Yes, right. Well, it's like anything else. Add social as a modifier and you have nothing meaningful, usually, right? So that's just an opening bit about Aristotle. I'm just enjoying the spectacle of the New York Times and other people like them being horrified that you'd actually admit this as a legitimate basis of human knowledge.
To oversimplify, John, what I would say you learn from Aristotle is that human beings have a place in the world, a place in nature that is not determined by human beings, is not a product of their will. They have a telos, an ultimate happiness that is, again, not determined by their will, which is basically the polar opposite of everything the left believes today. And that's why Aristotle, who's very accessible, I believe. I mean, you know, you can study Aristotle for years and never really understand him, but you can understand quite a bit on a first and second reading. An undergraduate can learn quite a bit from reading Aristotle, a decent translation of Aristotle, or, you know, like I did it in the original Greek. But my point, it really, it's accessible in a way that, you know, Kierkegaard's not. It's so different, as Steve pointed out, in a kind of different light, so different from what most students have ever been exposed to, that I find that most students actually enjoy reading Aristotle. I assign Aristotle's ethics, Nicomachean ethics, to my students in my cyber law ethics and policy course. And they're usually fascinated by, you know, these are geeky guys, you know, the old joke about how you can tell if a cyber guy's an extrovert, he looks at your shoes instead of his. That's the kind of the guys I have in the class. They're wonderful, but they love this stuff because they've never been exposed to it. You know, they were probably
can I ask you something? Gender studies. Let me ask you something. How exactly does Aristotle relate to cyber warfare, cyber regulation? Like, what do you tell them?
Take my class, John. You gotta take my class.
No, that's not happening. But the reason I ask is I think this is kind of the theme of people at the New York Times, or at least a smart undergraduate would say, it's all nice and good, but this is a guy, right? He lived 2,500 years ago and wrote, before there was any, you know, industry, there was really very little writing. There were almost no library, but, you know, they would just say it's so long ago and so out of context. How does it really help us?
Okay,
it's like reading about Ptolemy's theory of the spheres, you know,
response? Let me just really quickly, because I don't want to beat this horse to death, but I've talked about this before. Another philosopher that I assigned very, very briefly, just to show how ludicrous it is this guy named Floridi, who's a technology philosopher, or a philosopher of technology. And he has this, I know it's awful. He has this theory that we need to treat network systems, computers, laptops, other kinds of technological systems as moral beings worthy of right? So compare that to Aristotle, from whom you can, if you study the Nicomachean Ethics, what has changed about human ethics in 2,500 years? And what about that does not apply to technology? I mean, seriously, if you think about how human beings ought to behave with respect to one another. So I'll give you an example of a big ethical dilemma in cyber. Should a pen tester, you know what a pen tester does, go in and they look for deficiencies and breaches and security,
white hat.
When does a white hat become a black hat? And where's the line drawn? And what is the ethical difference between a white hat and a black hat? On the one hand, you can say anybody who breaks into a system is breaking the law. Mm. How does the law even distinguish? Where do we get the set of, excuse the word, values that will allow us to distinguish between a white hat and a black hat? And why do we do that? You know, all of those things Aristotle has answers for, even if he never imagined a pen tester breaking into the industrial control system that runs a water treatment plant. You know,
let me try.
Steve.
Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah, let me try one more answer, John, and then we'll let you go. We'll let you off the hook for now. Although clearly we need a lot of patience in sorting you out. Look, of course, we don't read Aristotle's Physics anymore. A lot of that was wrong. We might read it for just some antiquarian interest in a couple of peculiar things. But the Politics and the Ethics, they lay out some permanent problems. So let me go backwards. I think it is an incontestable finding of modern social science that the left nevertheless, is that families are the optimal social unit for human flourishing, the raising of children and for having stable communities and a stable political order. That's how Aristotle's Politics begins. That the polis is based on the families. But of course, what is required for families to flourish? Well, that becomes matters of individual virtue, which is what the ethics are about. So,
and it also means you know the difference between a man and a woman and how they co-create.
Well, there is that, yes. So the point is that here's the reciprocal aspect of families and state. Aristotle didn't use the word state. He used polis, right, from which we get politics, but it kind of meant political order, social order, right? Man's a political being. And he said, look, if the state is bad, you're going to have bad families. If the families are bad, you're going to have a bad state. So you have to get both of those things right, and they go together. you won't find that taught in political science anywhere today, or for, you know, most mainstream academic political science. And that's why it's very useful to see how he lays out those problems in great detail and at great length. It's not just a, you know, it goes well beyond this little sketch I've just given. That's merely the beginning of Aristotle's approach to social thought there.
Steve.
What?
You're supposed to take over, Steve.
Am I supposed to talk about headlines
now? This is part of the podcast.
All right. I mean, you know, we really do need to have some amusement value out of this podcast. I was struck, John, with the juxtaposition of the White House, the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, where the media get together to pat themselves on the back of how great they are, and the famous Met Gala, where, of course, last year, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez turned up with a tax the rich dress on, but it accepted a $30,000 ticket in violation of health ethic rules. And, you know, these two ridiculous things, right, back to back. And, you know, our friends at the New York Post, who do write the greatest headlines in history, as we know, they had, what's his name, that, you know, the British guy whose name I'm forgetting, but his
Piers Morgan,
that's it. So Piers Morgan's op-ed in the New York Post had the wonderful headline, "Spare me these sickeningly hypocritical Met Gala celebrity cockroaches." Yeah, I wonder what he really thinks, right?
Well, you look at the pictures of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where President Biden appeared and made jokes about how he has no press conferences and doesn't answer press questions, and the press laughs at it like that's funny. But it did show, when you looked at all those pictures, that Washington really is Hollywood for ugly people.
Yes.
And if Washington, because they both, and the Met Gala, they both depend on celebrity culture. Isn't it also a sad commentary that the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, which is supposed to be one of the great repositories of culture in our country, is having a costume dress-up ball?
Yeah.
And adding designers as on a par with, you know, the great painters and sculptors of Western civilization.
And AOC.
Right. She didn't go this year because she couldn't get a free ticket,
I don't think. Because of her ethics violation she committed last year. Well, seriously, I'm not making a joke. She's actually being investigated, it's slightly less what they do in the ethics committee, because she didn't pay for her $40,000 dress. She didn't pay for her $30,000 ticket. Right. The $40,000 dress that said "tax the rich" on it. Do you guys remember this?
Yeah. Can I say this is a great story that Steve brought us, but I think could possibly be outmatched by another headline, which was that the White House called the leaders of the artificial intelligence companies to Washington for a meeting to discuss concerns about the safety of AI, and brought in to address them Kamala Harris.
I would say the punchlines write themselves, but that's kind of the point of AI, isn't it?
Maybe they'll start writing their speeches, and then we won't have any more material for the end of our podcast.
Can I say just one more thing about the press, the big White House dinner, John? I used to crash that thing back in the aughts. Did you ever go to the thing at all, or no? Probably not.
No.
Here we go for another pretentious name dropping from Steve.
I'm going to do that. I didn't actually crash the dinner because you couldn't get in. However, back in the aughts when you still
had parties, you crashed the parties.
Yes, I crashed they were always pre-parties. See, you'd have all these back when the media actually made money, they would have these pre-dinner receptions in, you know, various little, you know, rooms there at the Washington Hilton. And I would put on a bow tie and a pinstripe suit, so it looked like I was kind of in a tux. And I would just crash these things. Come on in. And, you know, they always had great food and drinks and stuff. And you would see some Hollywood celebrities did come, and the paparazzi be trailing them around, taking pictures. And I thought that was pretty funny. They all quit doing that when they all, you know, after the 2008 financial crash and media started going bankrupt left and right. And now that's not done anymore. And I think I did go to a couple of after parties. I wouldn't want to go to the actual thing itself. I think, you know, that room in the Hilton, John, it's the biggest room in Washington. But the White House dinner, they pack people in so tightly you can barely move. And I'd never want to go to a event. Okay. But last time about this, they gave out awards to themselves, of course, because what would be a gathering without giving yourself an award? So here's the first one. They're all this ludicrous, and I'll put a link in the show notes. The first award was the Aldo Beckman Award for Overall Excellence in White House Coverage to Matt Visor of the Washington Post. Gosh, what a surprise, someone from the Washington Post. Here's the description. And I hope you have an air sick bag near you, Lucretia, because you won't believe this. Matt Visor stood out among his competitors for work that went beyond the humdrum of covering the managed events of the presidency and White House. Visor captured the spirit of Joe Biden, particularly with his stories on how the president's brother and his Catholic faith influenced his strategic vision of the office. His sourcing on the James Biden story was unusual.
No more.
You can't stand anymore.
you can't give as much credence to these people and and repeat what they say.
I'm trying to read it in my best sarcastic manner.
You're doing fine. You're not the problem, but you shouldn't read this. It's awful.
You can't.
What we don't know about this is.
But people have to hear this to not believe it, right? I mean, this is all the awards are like this, of all these, you know, lips attached to the rear end of Democratic politicians. It's unbelievable.
They give Pulitzer prizes to the New York Post and the New York Times and Washington Post, right, for their Russia coverage. The
Russia coverage, I know, right? Yes. Yeah.
Why are we playing this game? I don't get it. Sorry.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Well, let me close this out by taking note of something Steve was very happy about, which is that McDonald's is bringing back the Oreo McFlurry, which is always welcome. Though I don't actually like Oreo cookies, but I do like the McFlurry, and I find that they should change the flavors more often. This is only a prelude to what make me very happy, which is if the Shamrock Shake became permanent, but they're never going to do that. Just because I like making fun of the Irish. But let me close out with the traditional.
Wait a second, John. I mean, there's one thing that I haven't seen any reporting on. Does this mean they've actually fixed their ice cream machines at McDonald's? They're always seem to be broken, right?
Oh, no, they're always broken because the McFlurry is such a delicacy. It involves sort of high-tech machinery. Although, you know, actually, did you know there's a soft serve machine, I think, is the most broken down equipment at McDonald's. You know, that $1 cone is actually, for some reason, very hard for McDonald's to keep running. I don't know why.
Because they've been milking the soft-serve power dividend.
Oh, on that note, we got to close out. We're on a comedic high. So,
I have to add to it, John, with a lost show ender that we haven't remembered to say for a long time. But since we have our esteemed vice president as the AI czar now, the artificial intelligence czar, thank goodness she's going to solve the problems that all of the major tech great minds think is unsolvable. Thank God we have Kamala. So that leads me to say, now is the time. It is time to drink our whiskey that we have been drinking, and that time is every day.
But I think John may have a camelism for us.
Well, I hope so.
So always drink your whiskey neat. Let's go, Brandon. And this week's camelism. So I think it's very important, as you've heard from so many incredible leaders for us at every moment in time, and certainly this one, to see the moment in time in which we exist in our present, and to be able to contextualize it, to understand where we exist in the history and in the moment as it relates not only to the past, but the future.
He didn't read it with sarcasm in his voice. He just read a deadpan. Wait a minute. Before you sign off, that was
just as Aristotle would have said it.
I actually, I think I was going to add, you just stole my line, which was, it sounds like Aristotle to me.
No.
Or at least an AI. This is what you say, AI, please write me some original Aristotle.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Before we go, since I think it's my job to do these things, I do want to bemoan the loss of a great American, was he American? I don't know. Gordon Lightfoot.
He was Canadian.
Was he Canadian? That's what I thought of when, as soon as I said a great American. So he was Canadian. That's okay. I still really liked his music because two reasons. One, he's got that great line in Sundown where he says, "She's a hard loving woman, got me feeling mean." Maybe the best line of any folk song ever. And I was once on the Edmund Fitzgerald. My uncle was a merchant sailor many, really? Many years ago, long before it went down and long before the song, which itself was a long time ago. I was a kid, but I toured the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Well, who's name dropping now?
The Edmund Fitzgerald's a boat. You can't name drop a boat.
Yes, you can.
Oh, okay. It was a boat. Okay.
On that note,
Bye, everyone. Let's...
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Hey, whiskey, you're the devil, you're laid me astray. Over hills and mountains into a merry cave. You're sweeter, stronger, tastier, you're spunkier, nate. Oh, whiskey, you're me darling, drunk or sober. Oh, no, brave boys, we're on for marching up to Portugal and Spain. Drums are beating, banners flying, the devil a home we'll have tonight.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.